Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, May the 14th. So did you catch the Mitt Romney interview on 60 Minutes last night? He told Mike Wallace a lot of things, including how he disapproved of his Mormon faith's now outlawed practice of polygamy.
There's part of the history of the church is past that I understand is troubling to people. Polygamy, which was outlawed in our church in the 1800s, that's troubling to me. I have great-great-grandfather. They were trying to build a generation out there in the desert, and so he took additional wives as he was told to do, and I must admit, I can't imagine anything more awful than polygamy.
Mitt Romney's faith was also the focus of back-and-forth charges between Romney's campaign and the Reverend Al Sharpton last week. Sharpton, in a debate with Christopher Hitchens about faith and politics, said,
"And as for the one Mormon running for office, those that really believe in God will defeat him anyway, so don't worry about that. That's a temporary situation.
Sharpton insists he wasn't criticizing the Mormon faith, but he was saying that Christians would defeat Romney for political reasons. He also said he was comparing Christians who really believe in God with people like Christopher Hitchens, who do not. Hitchens at the time was criticizing the Mormon church's one-time practice of not allowing blacks in as members of the church. So all of this prompted us to want to examine Mitt Romney a little bit closer, in particular, but not exclusively, his religion, and whether it would hurt his chances or not of being elected president. And we found a guest who admires Mitt Romney, who wrote a book about him entitled A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. And we will invite your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, 263-1890, or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. So we're going to talk about Mitt Romney this hour and how his faith is being discussed on the campaign trail. And but also, though, we will talk about Mitt Romney in general and whether or not he is changing his positions on social issues to appeal to the more conservative base of the Republican Party, an issue that also came up in the 60 Minutes interview last week. Our guest is Hugh Hewitt. He is the host of a nationally syndicated radio show and the executive editor of townhall.com. He is currently a constitutional professor of law at Chapman University Law School. He served 6 years in the Reagan administration in a variety of posts, including in the White House counsel's office. He is the author of many books, including A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, you also did a series for PBS on religion, right?
Yes. In the mid-90s, PBS sent me off to talk to a number of people of faith, different traditions, and one of those stops was Salt Lake City, where I interviewed extensively and actually became pretty good friends with a man by the name of Neil Maxwell, who was an elder in the Mormon church at that time, an apostle, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. The LDS faith was quite new to me. I'm not a Mormon, never have been, don't have any Mormons in my family. But I found the history of the church to be quite fascinating. And for those of your listeners who don't know, the Mormon church is governed rather hierarchically. There is a first presidency, which includes the prophet, and two counselors for a total of three. And then there's the Quorum of the Twelve beneath that three, or actually adjacent to it. And those 15 individuals, all men, have direct control over all of the LDS operations worldwide. There are nearly 6 million Mormons in the United States and about the same number abroad.
Yeah, and LDS means Latter-day Saints?
Yes.
Yeah. You know Mitt Romney, too?
Yes, I got to know him in the course of writing this book. When I sat down with my publisher and said, based upon what I learned about the Mormon faith, if Romney got in and made a competitive run, it would be a significant issue that we could get ahead of. They agreed, and we presented the proposition to the campaign. that he sit down with me in the fall and late summer of last year for extensive interviews. At first they said, no, we don't think so, and then I pressed and they agreed, and so I had a lot of access to the governor at the time.
Yeah, and I believe I read in there that while you haven't formally endorsed anybody yet, if the election, the California primary were to be held today, you would be voting for Mitt Romney?
That's right. I didn't endorse him. I simply told people that based upon what I saw, he is an exceptionally qualified individual to become the president, and if the California primary were held today, I'd vote for him over Rudy Giuliani and John McCain and the others. However, a campaign is partly about seeing how people do on the road. I'm sure many of your listeners will remember Edmund Muskie looked pretty good until he cried on the back of a truck. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people look very good until the lights come on and the race begins. Now, Romney has had a very good first quarter in fundraising and organization. He had a great debate last week. He had a very good turn on 60 Minutes last night. And so he's beginning to show that he's got the distance, but as I discuss in A Mormon in the White House, lots of time between now and Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida, so we'll wait and see.
Talk a little bit more about Mitt Romney's resume and how it is, looks pretty good, but yet this question is there. It's the one fly in the ointment.
It is an intimidating resume, Joy. Many of your listeners in Madison are used to academic credentials of the first order, so I'll just run through them for you. He was enrolled originally at Stanford, then went on his LDS mission to France for 30 months and returned to BYU, where he finished first in his class. From BYU, he moved on to Harvard Business School and Harvard Law School, taking a joint degree, graduating cum laude from the law school, and is a Baker Scholar from the Harvard Business School, which is the top 5%. From there, he joined Bain & Company, one of the nation's three preeminent business consulting firms. And after a decade there, learning the Bain way, which is a significant part of his background, he founded Bain Capital, an investment firm, some venture capital, some simply investment, and made himself and many other people very, very wealthy. He was a billionaire. He's now been transferring assets into family trusts, et cetera, so I don't know what his financial disclosure will say when he files it in a few weeks, but he'll have at least a couple of $100 million left over under his control. And he did it the old-fashioned way. He just thought how to make money by investing and changing companies. After that, he went to the Salt Lake City Games at the request of the governor of Utah and many people in the community. Took over a disaster, really, in 1998. The games were broke. They had no sponsors. They were awash in corruption and scandal. Turned it around and made it a tremendous success, even though it occurred just months after 9/11. At the conclusion of the games, Republicans and many Democrats and independents in Massachusetts appealed to him to return to the Bay State, run for office there, where he had lived since graduating from the business school. And he agreed to, and they elected him largely because they were broke, out of gas, and out of ideas. Served 4 years there and then began his run for the presidency.
Yeah. The Bain way, explain that, please.
Bain & Consulting, Bain & Company is a consulting firm which developed when Bain, the founder, left something called the Boston Consulting Group and said, we can do this better. Business consultants arrive like the Marines in a company that's struggling, analyze everything, draft recommendations, and leave. Bain & Company said, we'll do a couple of things differently. One, we'll adopt the traditional consulting group approach, which depends heavily upon data and objectivity, marry to it contrarian analysis, and then stay after the reports are written until the turnaround occurs, embedding themselves, in essence, in a company until such time as the difficult changes are made in the culture. It depends primarily on the tool called the strategic audit, a volume of data, which is really astonishing, and then this sort of grinding contrarian analysis over and over and over again until not total consensus, but a clear weight of opinion on direction and initiatives develops out of a combination of very, very smart people around the table. That Bain way has become Romney's hallmark, both in his own venture capital company, Bain Capital, which had no connection except in the name to the Bain Consulting Group, and then at Salt Lake in Massachusetts, and I suspect in his campaign, which has been extraordinarily innovative thus far.
Yeah, and I only bring that up because he has said that the Bain way might be a way for him to reform Washington.
Yes, he believes that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and things such as diverse Defense Department spending are all archaic, that they have been conducted the same way and the debates have been waged on the same terrain for the last 40 years, and that what needs to happen is sort of the sophisticated techniques of management, which have really not been applied to date.
So is his faith going to hurt his chances for being elected president?
Well, I like to compare it to the 20th mile of the Boston Marathon. Those of your listeners who are runners know that that's the big hill. That's the heartbreak hill. And if you get to the top of it, you feel pretty good, and you're ahead of the pack. And if you don't get to the top of it, you don't finish the race. For Romney, the fact that he's a Mormon is his heartbreak hill. It is either going to make or break his campaign. Thus far, it's going pretty well. The attacks on the Mormon faith have come most vociferously from the left, from Jacob Weisberg of Slate Magazine, a cover story in The New Republic by Damon Linker, an editorial in The New York Times by Ken Woodward, who was longtime editor of the religion pages at Newsweek, most recently by, of course, Al Sharpton. Now, having Al Sharpton as your critic is really a great benefit in American politics. He is generally viewed as a charlatan and as a schemer and as a divisive figure. And he certainly proved that when he attacked all Mormons and then attempted to lie his way out of it last week. I'm glad you played the clip of him doing that. So, yes, he's taken a lot of slings and arrows. There are some evangelicals who have also thrown some bricks at him, because the theological gap between the Mormons and evangelicals and Catholics is quite frankly, too great to be bridged. They believe very, very different things, as any student of religion will tell you. But the manifestation of those very different beliefs looks a lot the same. Romney's been married to Anne for 36 years, got these five wonderful boys who are married to five daughters-in-law, and he's got 10 grandchildren. He is esteemed by everyone who knows him as a man of tremendous character, and he's as square as a right angle. I mean, they're just not going to be able to lay a glove on him for any of the reasons that other candidates have faltered in the past. So I think it will be both good and bad, and thus far, as he pushes his way through it, I think it's turning out to be a good thing.
Yeah, you don't buy Al Sharpton's explanation that he said that religious people would defeat Mitt Romney for political reasons.
I think we ought to apply to Al Sharpton the same standard he applied to Don Imus, which is to listen carefully to what he said and judge it by reasonable basis. And it was clearly a bigoted statement by a bigoted man against an entire faith tradition.
When he says those who really believe in God, why is that a bigoted statement against the Mormon faith?
It would be like saying, substitute into that Jew or Muslim or Buddhist. If he said, as for the Buddhist in the race, those of us who really believe in God will defeat him. As for the Muslim in the race, those of us who really believe in God will defeat him. As for the Jew in the race, those who really believe in God will defeat him. I think what America is developing is the same ear for anti-Mormon bigotry that it has long possessed for anti-African-American bigotry, for anti-Semitic bigotry. And Al Sharpton's a bigot, and sure, bigots hate to be called that, and they hate to be heard on tape, but there is simply no way that that was the context, and no reasonable person could conclude that. He's pretty much a disgusting character.
Mormons believe in God.
Of course they do, mm-hmm. Yes.
We are talking with Hugh Hewitt, who is the host of a nationally syndicated radio show and the executive editor of townhall.com. He is also the author of A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, if there's something you want to know about Mitt Romney. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. And this is a complete coincidence, but after 4 o'clock this afternoon, Ben Marins is going to be talking with Christopher Hitchens, who has a new book out called God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Christopher Hitchens was debating Al Sharpton last week when Al Sharpton made his controversial remarks about Mitt Romney and the Mormon faith. Again, Al Sharpton says he was misinterpreted, but his statement was As for the one Mormon running for office, those who really believe in God will defeat him anyways, so don't worry about that. That's a temporary situation. We're talking with a guest who knows a lot about Mitt Romney, who admires Mitt Romney very much, would likely vote for him if the California primary were held today. He wrote a book, A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. He's talking with us about the Sharpton remarks and about Mitt Romney's interview last night on 60 Minutes and answering any questions that you have about Mitt Romney. You say, Hugh Hewitt, that you think Mitt did a good job on 60 Minutes last night?
Yes, and I think that the more this has been his trajectory throughout his career, the more people see of him, the more they are impressed with him. And while there was a lot of static going in about the premarital sex question, in fact, he handled it rather deftly. My colleague at HughHewitt.com, Dean Barnett, has written about the interview last night, and I'd recommend people see that analysis. So as with the Reagan Library debate of last Tuesday night, one of the things I think the Republican primary field is finding out is that you really don't want to share a stage with Mitt Romney. He unfortunately for them, he's from Central Casting. He looks great. He knows how to present. And again, I think this goes back to the investment banking side. As those involved in finance know, most of your life is spent in front of hostile audiences trying to persuade them to invest a lot of money. And you become very proficient at explaining complicated transactions. The most complicated transaction in American politics is persuading someone to vote for you for president. And that training of presentation after presentation, honed when he went shopping for Olympic sponsors, is beginning to show through quite dramatically, I think.
Yeah, and we have lots of callers who want to talk with you, but I do want to ask one more question about the 60 Minutes interview last night and the talk about Mitt Romney's Mormon faith. He did acknowledge that a lot of people probably could be troubled by the church's past history of polygamy, and he talked about how he abhorred the thought of polygamy. Do you think that's people have a stereotype of who Mormons are and what they believe, and that's why it could possibly hurt him?
Well, you know, Joy, I spoke to literally dozens of people in writing A Mormon in the White House, from people in the center and on the left, like Doris Kearns Goodwin, eminent historian, and the editor of Newsweek, talking about, you know, what did they know about Mormons, all the way through to people on the right like Charles Colson. I interviewed the Archbishop of Denver, Charles Chaput. I talked with, wherever I went, I asked people, the former Mike McCurry, the head of Clinton Communications. Anyone I could find, I asked them, what do you know about the Mormons? What do you think about them? What do you think about a Mormon in the White House? That's where the title came from. I kept asking, what about a Mormon in the White House? And the answers I got came down to, either, oh, that doesn't matter, and it shouldn't matter. And I liked what Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote, or we talked about, and how Lincoln asked not to be judged on his rather peculiar faith, but on the conduct of his life. You hear that in an echo often in the way that Romney talks about it. Through one of the editorial page editors at the Wall Street Journal said to me, you know, it's out there, not owning the statement, but relaying it, it's out there that this is a 150-year-old version of Scientology. And so the objections to the Mormon faith ended up not being about polygamy. Most people realize it's just silly. Polygamy hadn't been a part of the church in 100 years plus. And it's not really about the fact that the priesthood of the church was limited to was not open to African Americans until 1978. Blaming Romney for doctrinal traditions is sort of like blaming Giuliani for Urban VIII's imprisonment of Galileo, or McCain for having Calvin preside over the execution of Servetus. I mean, you just don't own those things, and it's never been the tradition. But the three concerns are, would Salt Lake City attempt to influence the presidency? And he answers that directly in The Mormon in the White House, and emphatically not, in the same way that John Kennedy did in 1960. The second is, from evangelical people concerned about the theological divide, we know there are 60,000 Mormon missionaries at work in the world. What would a president of that faith do to their missionary work? Would it supercharge it? And the answer is, it hasn't in Massachusetts, And as Archbishop Chaput said to me, and it would be a shame upon evangelical or Catholic circles to set sail to their fears that way simply because their missionary efforts lack. And then finally, and I think most pervasively, it's just too weird. The Mormon faith has a very unusual, in fact, extraordinary founding narrative. I'm faithful to it. I used the text of my former colleague at the Department of Justice long ago and far away, Rex Lee, to recount Joseph Smith's narrative in the founding of the church. And that narrative strikes a lot of Americans as simply beyond belief. But then I point out to them, as do many of my interlocutors in the book, all religion involves things that are beyond belief. And we do not hold and we do not launch inquisitions about the particulars of religious belief, at least we haven't to date, because we realize that once you do that, everyone's faith becomes on the table, and that's really what Article 6 mm-hmm. of the Constitution was intended to prevent in a public way, and I hope in a private way as well.
To the phones we go. Jason in Milwaukee is first. Good morning.
Hello. I'm LDS, and I just kind of have a couple of comments here, and I'll try to make them very brief. First of all, your guest said the most vociferous attacks have come from the left. And, you know, I really find that to not be true. For example, I have never heard Harry Reid's, LDS religion criticized. It's a non-issue. And I would say that's because on the left, people really don't care what your religion is. I'm much more worried about Dobson's focus on the family. You can go to their website this morning. They still say Mormons are a cult. To me, that's very, very troubling. Romney's 60 Minutes last night, you know, I found his statement on polygamy a little bizarre, that he can't imagine anything more awful. You know, genocide is more awful. There's many things that are more awful. It's an embarrassment. It's maybe a blight on our history. But to so, you know, clearly say it in terms that are just designed to appease the far right is a little bothering to me. And, you know, that goes, I think, to a larger issue of how Mormons are viewed worldwide. Even your guest is sort of talking like LDS people are this sort of monolithic group of people who vote lockstep. And that's just really not true. If you look at over half of the members of the church live outside the United States. Sociological studies by people like Wilford DeCoe have shown that those members tend to be linked to the political spectrum. And on top of that, LDS people outside of the United States, when they become Mormon, they shift left, even in places like Belgium and the Netherlands. So, you know, I'm bothered by this Romney, because he's sort of portraying all LDS people as these sort of Osmond-esque people. We have there's a great diversity among us.
Yeah, and you know, you gave us so many things to talk about, Jason. I'm going to hold you at that last point. Hugh Hewitt?
Sure. Respond to a number of things. As he correctly points out, half of the Mormons do live abroad. I noted that. He's simply wrong, though. I mean, really wrong about where the attacks, the most vociferous and public attacks, have come from Romney. Now, I listed four of them specifically, and those attacks were on Romney specifically. Al Sharpton, Jacob Weisberg, editor of Slate magazine, Kenneth Woodward in the New York Times, and the cover story in the New Republic. Those are very specific attacks by high-profile lefties, liberals, upon Mitt Romney's qualification for the presidency because of his faith. I asked Jason, perhaps he has a specific attack upon Romney from the right. I know of some. They're from low-profile people.
Well, he said Dobson's...
Dobson does not attack Romney. In fact, he said he could consider mm-hmm. voting for him. The Christian evangelical critique of the Mormon faith is there, but not upon Romney. And I think this mm-hmm. is where people have got to ask themselves, be very, very careful. Theological debates between sects will go on forever, and that's part and parcel of American public American political history. The attacks upon a particular candidate because of his faith is what is repugnant. That's what's coming from the left, and I don't think, nor should we ever expect, the theological debate to subside between not just Mormons and evangelicals. There's a good, healthy conversation underway right now. I quote at length in A Mormon in the White House, a discussion with a couple of evangelical theologians from Biola about those ongoing debates. But your caller's simply wrong about where the negative attacks on Romney because of his faith has come. Moreover, he brought up Harry Reid. Harry Reid, absolutely, I agree with him. There are lots of of liberal Mormons, lots of them. I think the church is probably 80-20, if you could get inside people's heads. You don't have anything like that, 80-20, 90-10, voting for Republicans over Democrats. But there are clearly liberal Mormons like Harry Reid. We've never seen the sort of attacks on Harry Reid because, again, it's just alien to our culture, and I hope it's alien to our presidential race.
Thank you, Jason, for the call. Many others who want to get in on this, so let's move on. Lance in Antioch. Hi, Lance. You're on the air.
Hi, Hugh.
Hey, good morning, Lance.
I listen to you a lot on WIND. So
thank you.
I've heard you talk about your book, and I know a lot of your positions on this. As far as I agree with the one point, if Mitt Romney is the nominee, Republican nominee, I'm going to vote for him. However, I would say when people talk about Mitt Romney and Mormons in general being Christians, and that's a misnomer. And as an evangelical Christian, I do have a problem with that portion of them being called Christians. In the first place, they threw down the gauntlet first. Mormons, they're more, you've read their statement. Obviously, you said you put it in the front of your book that Joseph Smith said that all Christian religions, the historic Christian faith, Catholics, Protestants, Eastern Orthodox, they're all an abomination to God. They threw down the gauntlet first. So it's not like we're the bigots attacking Mormonism. It's more like defending the historic Christian faith against somebody who says that we are totally wrong, totally outside of God's realm and God's blessings.
No, I don't believe that it is bigoted to have theological debates. And it is absolutely true that Mormons are not Trinitarians. They cannot sign on to the Nicene Creed. And as I said early in the interview, the theological chasm between Mormons and evangelicals and Catholics cannot really be bridged, although we often have seen common cause between Mormons, evangelicals, and Catholics in various public policy areas. It is not bigoted to debate theology. It is bigoted to say, I won't vote for that person because he or she is a Mormon. I won't vote for that person because he or she is a Jew. I won't vote for that person because he or she is an African American. The assignment to an individual of a disqualification because of a group identity is the quintessential definition of bigotry. I didn't hear you say that. In fact, I heard you say you'd vote for Romney.
I would vote for him if he was the nominee.
So that's not my view bigoted. But my view, if you want to debate theology all day long, it's fascinating. Mormons will debate theology with you endlessly. I mean, I spent dozens of hours with an apostle of the church talking about this and why they believe what they believe. And, of course, they have a canonical couple of texts, three more, actually, that evangelicals and Roman Catholics do not admit into the canon. I don't view it as a particularly useful discussion to say, are you or are you not a Christian? I always like to go to the substance of the debate and put it out there. Again, though, that's a theological debate, not a political one. And I caution evangelicals and Catholics that to invite that debate into the public square is to invite secularists and atheist absolutists to drive them from the square next, that the Mormon question is really the weak flank for people of faith in politics, and they've got to be concerned that if Romney is disqualified because of his faith, well, then next up will be evangelicals and Catholics and Pentecostals, because we all believe extraordinary things.
Thank you, Lance. Next is Janice in La Crosse. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Joy, and your guest. Yes, I'm a Catholic, and I really like Brombeck, but nobody wants to go there with the media because they went Clinton, Obama, and, you know, Mitt Romney and the rest of them, Giuliani, helpless. Anyway, I listened last night, and, you know, I'm very pro-life, obviously, so when I heard him say he was not pro-life, but then he switched his opinion, as Mike Wallace said, how is it you changed your opinion? And I'm glad he did. That's wonderful for me. But, you know, then he also had a thing with the NRA, and I'm also not for guns and that type of thing. And so, you know, and now he's a member of the NRA, and they said that's rather contradictory also once he was against them, and then he's a member. Anyway, you know, I don't know. Let me just say I'm for Brombeck, so
well,
go for it.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Hugh Hewitt, about the that line of questioning from Mike Wallace last night on whether or not, and I've heard this from others too, whether or not Mitt Romney has switched his position to appease to the conservative base?
And the answer is no. He didn't do it to appease the conservative base. By the way, Sam Brownback's great American. I like Senator Brownback. I've had him on my program quite a lot. Unfortunately, does not have traction or money, and as a result, he really isn't going to be competitive in this race, but he's a good person to have out there speaking on behalf of life issues. I direct Janice and other people concerned about the life issue to the conversation I had with Archbishop Chaput in the book, and to my lengthy conversations. I have a whole chapter in A Mormon in the White House on why Romney went from being pro-choice to being pro-life. And Chaput's bottom line is, we need a lot more people to make this journey. Lots of people on the left have gone the other way, like Al Gore started out pro-life, ended up pro-choice, like Richard Gephardt started out pro-life, ended up pro-choice. Romney started out pro-choice and has ended up pro-life. His narrative of that is a very compelling one, and I think most of the credit goes to, the positive credit goes to Peter Flaherty, his general counsel as governor, a great Irish Catholic mass-attending pro-lifers in the way that only Irish Catholic mass-attending pro-lifers can be, who paraded into Romney's office a succession of pro-life theorists and advocates, including Robert George of Princeton, a philosopher, Marianne Glendon of Harvard Law School, a number of them, occasioned by the demand for Harvard. That's my alma mater, so I can speak cruelly about it. Harvard wanted to set up an embryonic stem cell conveyor belt to create embryos for the purposes of destroying them. And Romney was horrified by that, and that debate in the middle of his governorship launched this inspection of his own positions, which led to his belief that Roe v. Wade needs to be overturned. It's a very important change. It is not a flip-flop. It's a flip in the worst sorts of words, and I think he is very persuasive, and he has persuaded a lot of the highest-level people in the pro-life movement that it is a genuine and profound change of opinion, and I believe it. On guns, he has not really changed. He's a moderate Second Amendment guy, meaning that along with many others, he has concerns about high-caliber weapons in the hands of private citizens, but recognizes the Second Amendment is an individual right, not a collective right. It's called the standard model analysis. And he hadn't changed at all on that, nor has he changed on gay rights. He has always been for the full and equal dignity of all Americans, regardless of their sexual orientation, and he has always been against and has fought vigorously against the imposition of same-sex marriage via courts upon a democratically controlled people. And perhaps more than any other elected official in the United States, he's done more to insist upon the people's choice in that regard, not the choice of courts.
Our guest is Hugh Hewitt. He is the author of A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890 if you have a question for him. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. You're listening to The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll join Kathleen Dunn and her guest after 9 o'clock for a look back at the major political headlines from last week. That's coming up after 9. We're talking about whether or not Mitt Romney could be elected president, and will his religious faith help or hurt him? Our guest is the author of A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. It's a question that's been in the news a lot in the past week or so. You may have heard about Reverend Al Sharpton saying some what many people called bigoted remarks about the Mormon Church in a debate last week. He said, as for the one Mormon running for office, those who really believe in God will defeat him anyways. Sharpton says he wasn't criticizing Romney's faith, but says he was contrasting himself with Christopher Hitchens, the atheist author who he was debating at the time. We also saw Mitt Romney in the first GOP candidate debate a week or so ago. Many say he was clearly the winner of that debate. And we saw Mitt Romney last night on 60 Minutes answering questions about his faith and other things. So we thought, let's talk about Mitt Romney this hour and how his faith is being discussed on the campaign trail, and whether or not he is changing his positions on social issues to appeal to the conservative base of the Republican Party, and whatever else you want to know about Mitt Romney. Dan in Rice Lake is our next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for this program. I have a question. Why Governor Romney? announced his presidential candidacy in his home state of Michigan. And then, if possible, I'd like a quick follow-up on his track record on health care financing in his state where he's governor. Thank you.
Sure. The reason he went to Michigan is because, of course, his father was the former Michigan governor. Mitt Romney was born in Michigan, retains very strong ties to Michigan, and in essence, as many people will go home to their hometown, that's where he went to announce that he was born, actually in Detroit, and then moved to a suburb of Detroit when his dad was running American Motors before he became governor. So as often candidates will do, they go to their hometown to launch their campaign.
And what about his health care stuff in Massachusetts?
Well, that's one of his innovations, and the jury's out whether it's going to work. He worked with the Democrats in the Massachusetts legislature, 8 out of 10, to take the genesis of a plan that came out of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, and mandate that every adult in Massachusetts carry health insurance, much in the way that most states mandate that every driver carry automobile insurance. It was the discovery of this Bane way applied to the healthcare problem in Massachusetts that there were many free riders in the system, primarily 18 to 30-year-olds who generally view themselves as invulnerable and willing to run the risk of catastrophic illness and therefore not be insured. The trouble is they get the care anyway when they do break a leg or an arm or a head, when they're involved in a motorcycle accident or a boating mishap. They still get the care, and that care immediately is assigned out to everyone in the pool, and it's disastrous for our healthcare system. So I think this innovation is going to prove to be very compelling in a couple of ways. Most people understand and admire the idea of personal responsibility in the country for your healthcare costs. And secondly, a one-size-fit-all solution out of the federal government, the Hillary Care model, for example, from the mid-90s, scares most sound people. They want to see a number of programs tried at the local and state level before any wholesale innovation that might disrupt the quality of care, though not the efficiency of care in the United States, is imposed from the federal government. So I think he spends a lot of time talking about it on the campaign trail. The downside, of course, is what's it going to cost? Is it going to be prohibitively expensive to do this? And that remains to be seen.
Ann in Waukesha, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. This is what I think is going to be the issue. The Mormon sacred scripture is extraordinarily racist, believing that those people with dark skin in this world have dark skin because they were cursed by God. And once, if Romney should get the nomination, that's going to be revealed, and Romney is going to have to say whether or not he agrees with his own sacred scripture. And I think that the race issue, not just the racist history of the Mormon Church, but the racist sacred text of the Mormon Church are going to be a real issue for Romney, and I would like to hear your comments about that.
Sure. The church in 1978 reinterpreted its scripture to remove that bar on service in the priesthood, both orders, from all people of different colored skin, and recognized and repented of its previous racialist past. Much like the Confederacy was built upon a completely bizarre reading of Old Testament and New Testament scriptures with regards to the institution of slavery, so the reinterpretation of scripture was something that the church authorities got to and did, and I don't believe it will generally travel. I don't think people are going to assign the worst elements of a religious tradition to its candidate. At least we haven't been doing so recently, and I haven't heard many people asking anyone from the South if they agreed with the Confederacy version of the sanction of slavery. I just don't think that travels.
Thank you, Ann. Justin in Madison is with us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, go ahead.
I'm just wondering about a natural contradiction that I view in Mitt Romney's stance regarding slavery and homosexuality. He seems to be saying repeatedly that certainly he is opposed to the systematic oppression of African Americans that occurred within the Mormon faith, despite the fact that a majority of Americans and a majority of people within his faith supported it at the time. And yet, with regards to homosexuality, that systematic oppression doesn't seem to matter for him as long as a majority are in support of it.
Well, actually, I don't think he says that at all. I think that's a pretty perverse reading of what he has said on both subjects. On discrimination, he is vehemently against it. He is vehemently against it with regards to race and with regards to sexual orientation. He is also against courts imposing their personal preferences without any kind of sanction of an elected representative upon the marriage issue. And I think your caller is referring to marriage. And what Romney points out, which I think is persuasive to the vast majority of Americans, as is evidenced by the number of initiatives that have gone to the ballot, and I think in 30 states, 29 of them have been successful, is that marriage is reserved for a man and a woman. That does not go to rights of civil union, doesn't go to equal dignity, rights of employment, housing, everything else, rights of survivorship, et cetera, or to the particulars of civil union legislation. It goes to the fact that not once in the nation's history has a elected legislature passed and an executive signed into law a law that says same-sex marriage shall be the law of the land. Not once. And as a result, the imposition by courts of their own particular bizarre philosophy is undermining of democracy. Now, and that's Romney's position, and I don't think it comports at all with what your caller says.
Next we go to Greg in Milwaukee. Hello, Greg.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I really thought that looking back at the Kennedy election in 1960, there was so much, I would say, you know, almost backward thinking about a Catholic coming into the presidency and all these concerns. And it's amazing that here we are 48 years later, and a lot of these same things come up. I don't think I saw that same type of reaction when Lieberman ran, who I might have been the first Jewish candidate. I might be mistaken on that. And the other comment I'd like to make that I would ask you to comment upon is that other than Ezra Taft Benson, can you think of anybody else who was Mormon and was on either and very high levels of the United States government on the cabinet? I think he was Secretary of Agriculture, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he was, and he went on to become prophet of the church. And no, I am not, though it wouldn't surprise me. Well, right now, Secretary of Health and Human Services Leavitt is, in fact, LDS. And so there's at least one. And, of course, we've had many senior Mormons in the House of Representatives, Mo Udall, for example. We've had some in the Senate, Orrin Hatch. Harry Reid, the majority leader of the United States Senate, is a Mormon. So we've had lots of Mormons in government for a long time, but I'm just unfamiliar with them. I will say this. You're right about the 47 years. And I went back and reread for a Mormon in the White House question mark, Teddy White's seminal works of the making of the president, 60, 64, and 68. 60 because of the Catholic issue, 64 and 68 because of the Mormon issue, because when George Romney briefly was considered as a stop Goldwater moderate Republican in 64, and then later when he made his ill-fated run for the presidency in 68, his faith did not make much of a splash at all. And I think that's because it was so soon in the wake of the Kennedy ugliness that most of elite opinion recognized bigotry for what it was and shunned it. Now, what's happened in the 47 years since then is that as I said earlier in the interview, we have a tin ear for anti-Mormon bigotry. We excuse it when a bigot like Al Sharpton comes up and makes bigoted remarks. We try and allow him to squirm out, and it's disgusting that we do so. I think we need one standard that we apply to Don Imus and one standard that we apply to Al Sharpton, which is that we are repulsed by bigotry. However, in 1960, it was in the interest of Democrats, liberals, and the left to help put the issue aside. In 2007, it is in the interest of Democrats, liberals, and leftists to attack Romney for his religion. And the viciousness on the left side of the political spectrum is so endemic and so deep that really it's poisoned the well in American politics to a level that I haven't seen in a long, long time. So any port in a storm and any hammer in a nail fight is, I guess, what's going on here. And so if the left can beat up on Romney because of his faith, they will, regardless of the historical precedents and the general revulsion we've felt for such tactics in the past.
Thanks to Greg. Craig now in Toma. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, it's Greg.
Gregs. Okay.
Two Gregs and two Justins this morning. I mean, we're running here.
That's okay. I listened to Mr. Romney for a little while last night, and actually what he spoke about scared me a little bit in that he said that he would like to increase our military troops by 100,000 troops. We already spend as much on our military as the rest of the world combined. And we are going to spend more money on it under him. And this sounds a lot like Reagan and Bush, where we have created the largest budget deficits in the world history.
Well, a couple of comments. We haven't really, as a percentage of gross domestic product. It's really quite small, defense spending below 4%, and at the height of Reagan, 6%, and at the height of Kennedy, even higher, of course, but that was Vietnam. And during FDR's time, we had deficits approaching 25 and 30% of GDP. A deficit is only a deficit in the context of how much you produce. But as to the 100,000 troops, in this regard, he's agreeing with Hillary Clinton and with pretty much everyone else, and that our defense spending is part of, and I'd recommend to the whole audience, the book, The Pentagon's New Map by Thomas Barnett. Now, Thomas Barnett is no Republican, no conservative. He's an advisor to both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton. But he makes an argument, I think, compelling, that our expenditures on defense are a very, very small price to pay for extending civilization into the chaotic portions of the world, and that our footprint has got to be large because we're the only one in the world that can do it, and that, therefore, if we want to avoid genocides in places like Rwanda in 1994, if we want to end them in places like Sudan, if we want to bring democracy to places in the Middle East which are nesting grounds and breeding grounds for extremism because of their oppression, we've got to pay the cost. And I view it as a bargain, as does Thomas Barnett, as does Hillary Clinton, as does Mitt Romney.
I'm looking at the piece that your colleague wrote for your blog, your website. The cheap shot was Mike Wallace grilling the Romney sons for not serving in the military. You thought that was a cheap shot, too?
Yes. I asked Mitt Romney right out of the box, why didn't you go to Vietnam? And his answer is very straightforward. Mm-hmm. He wasn't drafted. Now, that will either work for people or it won't, but it's very straightforward. He got 300 the year he came back from his mission. And 300 was not even remotely close to being drafted, so he was the benefit did not serve, did not get drafted because of his number. To bring up whether or not your kids have served is, again, something new. Ask yourself, did we ask if Al Gore's son went into the military? Mm-hmm. Did we ask if John Kerry's children went into the military? Did we? You know, we don't do that. They're not running for office, and it seems to me another extraordinary sort of, as Dean Barnett put it, HughHewitt.com, fetishization by people generally who don't concern themselves much with the well-being of the military about military service. And I don't think that will travel either. I think what's going to travel with Romney is whether or not people want someone committed to the war. And it's going to be a referendum on the war in 2008. It's going to be a referendum on who can best conduct it in the primaries. And that's, you know, all this other stuff is going to be blue smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. And Yvonne and Brown Deer, we're almost out of time, but you've been waiting such a long time, 30 seconds to make your point.
Well, I just wanted to, I had a lot of things to say, but I
30
remember,
seconds, please.
I remember Romney's father going into the desert and Kennedy saying, how do I campaign against a man who goes into the desert to pray? And so I think that's the lighthearted recognition of other people's faith. That would be really a healing thing.
Final remarks, Hugh Hewitt?
Well, the first Romney campaign was very instrumental in shaping Mitt Romney's approach to this campaign. I don't recall that particular anecdote, though I recall a similar one by Johnson talking about how do I run against a Mormon. George Romney was a great man and much loved and much admired, even though he's sort of a bad campaigner on the national stage. I recount why in A Mormon in the White House? I invite your listeners to get it and read it and think about it.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Joy, thanks for having me.
Hugh Hewitt, host of a nationally syndicated radio show and author of A Mormon in the White House. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.